Hello and welcome to the next in our series of podcasts for Equine Health Week 2024, all of which have been themed around the topic of equine well-being. We're coming towards the end of the week now, but there's still one big topic left to discuss, so big in fact, that we're spreading it across the weekend. The welfare of our horses has always been of the utmost importance, but conversation around the social acceptance of equestrian sport and what we can do to ensure our horses live the best lives possible while doing the jobs we ask of them has really come to the fore in recent years. That best life begins from the moment of conception, so a lot of thought must go into breeding and those crucial first years of a horse's life. To discuss this topic, I'm joined by two people with a real passion and knowledge for the development of young horses. First is Jane Nixon. She's the chair of the British Horse Foundation and a member of British Equestrians Equine Infectious Disease Advisory Group, amongst other roles. She developed a lifelong interest in equine development through 45 years as a practicing vet specialising in performance horses. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you. Hello, everyone.
And joining us as well is Kezia Allen. She is the secretary for the British Horse Foundation. She combines working as a research scientist at a busy NHS teaching hospital with a keen interest in equine husbandry research. And she's a keen rider, owner and breeder. Welcome, Kezia.
Hi, Rachel. Thanks very much.
So to get the ball rolling, and I've been asking most of our contributors this week, because our overall topic, as I've said, is equine wellness and well-being. What does that actually mean to you?
So I was going to kind of jump in first here, I think, and I'm sure Jane will add bits along the way. And I think for us, we talk about this a lot. I think it's important to be clear that equine well-being refers to, it's both the horse's physical and mental well-being. So I think we tend to focus more on the physical, perhaps, than the mental well-being. So to me, it means if your horse is physically well for the work they're being asked to do, and then are they happy and with a positive mental state? So I really like Jane has a quote about a horse with their cup always half full. So as much as we try, we can never create the perfect bubble world for our horses to live in. But if their cup is always half full in life, then when life is less than perfect, they're more likely to be able to adapt and cope. And to me, that, I think, is equine well-being.
I really like that, actually. That's really a nice way of putting it.
It is a nice way of putting it, because we all understand what that means. And there are two things I'd like to discuss that you brought up in your introduction, Rachel, please. The first one is that we're not just dealing from conception. We call it inception. That means when the owner, carer, manager starts to think about breeding, not when the deed is done. And that is, we'll talk about that later, but that is really just so important to think about the right mare and stallion, what you're actually looking for. And the other thing that we need to remember is we are not there just to pander to public perception. Public perception is extremely important, of course it is, to allow us to go ahead and not lose our social license. But we mustn't pander to public perception to the extent that the welfare of the horse is compromised. We must always follow the science.
Absolutely. And hopefully some of that science has been coming across in all the different topics that we've covered this week. So let's delve right into this then. Why is it so important that we give our horses a good start to life?
Well, if you don't mind if I take this one, it's very, very important. For the reason that we want them to have a good quality of sustainable life for a long period. Sustainability is the key word globally at the moment, but we're referring to sustainability in the horse. If a horse does not have a good start to its life, first of all, physically, which is really what I've built my practice on over the last 45 years, and gradually come round to realising that if a horse has suboptimal conformation, there is no way that that horse, by the time it is 8, is really going to be clinically perfectly free from lameness. Whereas if it has good, sustainable, correct conformation, it's quite likely to be completely free from lameness by the time it's in its late 20s. And I think I had one of the biggest thrills of my professional life the other day when I went to see a horse which was 8 years old, that I first betted it when it was 24 years old, as a horse for our local hunt, for the hunt staff. And I said at the time, the horse has got the nearest to possible confirmation that a hunter could have. And indeed he had. And he is now still completely free from lameness. And that was a wonderful thing. And so in my view, the first thing to consider is the horse going to stay free from lameness? And in that respect, he will then be free from any form of orthopedic pain, which is one of the major causes of us misunderstanding horses. And results of orthopedic anomalies can cause both physical and mental pain to the horse, and therefore their sustainability is reduced. So I can't impress upon people enough that they need to think about the right confirmation right from the beginning, and help maintain it through the animal's life.
And I think there as well, you also mentioned the mental side of that good start to life as well. That must have an impact as well.
Yes, you're quite right. It does. I think from the veterinarian's point of view, the orthopedic issues often predispose to mental pain and anguish. But then we're going to talk about this in a moment, I think, aren't we? But equally, if a horse is uncomfortable, and not in a positive mental state, whether it's an inherited characteristic or much more likely an acquired characteristic through poor management of the juvenile or baby horse, of course, that will cause problems later on. I'm extremely interested to realise that the Princess of Wales is very, very keen on children's welfare up to the age of 2, I think. And she's really leapfrogged us, and she's in front of us. And perhaps we need to look at this a little bit more carefully with regard to the horse.
Yes, I think if I can just sort of pop in there, I think that's sort of, you know, giving a horse a good start in life isn't just sort of making obviously the physical characteristics for the horse, and doing what you can to help that is obviously vital. But also equipping your horse with the right tools in its toolbox to be able to live in the world that we expect them to live in. Because it can be challenging for horses at times. It's our world, it's not their world, and we do expect them to just kind of crack on and figure all this stuff out. And I think it is our responsibility to make sure through good handling and positive interactions that they are able to cope. They do have the tools in their toolbox to be able to cope with the things that life is going to throw at them, because it's not something that nature has equipped them for. And I think, and also to give them the tools so that they can give you the answer that you're looking for. We stole another very good phrase from Judy Harvey, who liked to refer to equipping your foals to be good citizens, which I thought was actually a really, and again, just a nice little phrase. And she spoke at our conference in 2022. But yeah, giving them the tools to be good citizens for us. And I know we always need to be careful about kind of assigning human thought patterns and processes to horses, because they are different. But we never, as Jane was just saying, we do not chuck our children at the deep end and expect them to go to school at the age of 3 or 4. We let them in gently, and they go to play school, and they go to nursery for a couple of days, and they have preschool. And we slowly build them up, giving them sort of small bite-sized pieces of information that are, you know, at a rate that they can take in and understand, which allows them to sort of return the appropriate responses. So it's all about just setting them up for success in that way.
I couldn't agree with you more, Kezia. That's the rationale behind the British Horse Foundation, isn't it? Breeding for sustainability and setting them up correctly. But I regret that I do believe that an awful lot of equestrians and others seem to forget the evolution of the horse. Horses are animals which run away from danger. They have a fright-flight reflex. They do not stop to fight unless they're cornered. Stubbs knew this in his famous paintings several centuries ago, of the tiger jumping on the horse's back and the animal running away. We also know that horses are gregarious. They like to live with others. And they draw comfort from one another. And I think these features, if nothing else, the equestrian must bear these in the back of their mind at all stages when we are interacting with horses, but particularly when they're baby horses. And we feel, and this has been peer-reviewed time and again, that the young horse must socialise in the way in which it would do in the wild. So we need to be careful with regard to weaning. We should try not to wean them abruptly. It's better to have them in a group and take one mare away at a time. And then with regard to later life, when they have been weaned, it's better, much better, for yearlings to be out in a group in a big field, learning how to interact with one another, learning how to interact with the environment as a group. And they will be socially far more independent, and as Kezia says, primed for being good citizens, if we consider evolution at every stage.
You know, that's a very good point, actually, because we do have these horses in a very artificial environment to the one they were born to live in. So as you both said there, it's, you know, it's all about bridging that gap as much as we can and giving our horses as natural a life as possible, I guess.
When I referred earlier to we must not allow public perception to override welfare, I'd like just to give you an example of this when we're referring to keeping the horse out in the field as much as possible. There is no benefit in keeping a horse in a very wet, muddy field with a rug that is soaking wet. Because it's important for him to be outside all the time, only for him to get mud fever on his legs and rain rash on his back. So that's what I mean by a carefully balanced approach to management, taking the welfare of the horse first.
So what then, within this very crucial period we're talking about, what are some of the key developmental stages in that young horse's life?
Very, very good question and very important. The first thing is, in order to promote good conformation and sustainability, the horses should have limb conformation and the whole conformation, which is fit for purpose, in order to do the job that we require the animal to do. Now, this means avoiding at all costs angular and rotational limb deformities in both front feet and hind legs. It involves symmetry between the left and right front legs and the left and right hind legs. And most importantly, it involves symmetry between the left and right hoof capsules and the left and right front hoof capsules and the left and right hind hoof capsules, which I'm sure that Ben Benson has referred to already. And these can be assisted and modified by careful farriering. And the farrier should really look at the foal from between day one and day three, together with, if necessary, the vet, but certainly the carer. And a large percentage of young stock requires intervention simply by not corrective hoof trimming, but correct hoof trimming. At a regular intervals between 10 and 14 days for the first considerable period of the animal's life. And hand in hand with that is nutrition. It is no use the farrier doing a brilliant job with horses' hoof capsules if the foal has an imbalanced diet, becomes too heavy, becomes too light. And similarly, the management by the manager or carer of the horse, it's really important that they are not underloaded or over the limbs are not underloaded or overloaded, either on hard ground, muddy ground, too little turnout, too much turnout, too deep going. These all depend on the skill of the combined skill of the manager, carer, farrier, nutritionist, and veterinary surgeon. And that takes us up to the weaning process, which we've already discussed. And that is really, really important until the animal is actually mature. And of course, we all know that they mature at different times. The next stage is when training begins. Now, I use the word training. I do not use the word bitting. I do not use the word breaking. And that is where we do need to be aware of public perception. The horse's back is very sensitive. They've evolved to have a very sensitive back. And similarly, the horse's mouth is very sensitive, and the face of the horse and behind his ears and round his ears and above his eyes, they're all very sensitive areas. And therefore, if they're fitted with inappropriate saddlery, which is managed in a harsh manner, this will all be detrimental to the young horse, both in terms of physical detriment, which could have long-lasting effects, and perhaps more importantly, mental anguish, which they may take time, if ever, to forget. Horses have got very, very long memories. So I think that the first stage of training and the application of saddlery stroke tack, I think, needs to be done sympathetically but firmly and kindly. And I think this is a very big subject that perhaps needs further investigation.
Yeah, definitely. It's a real, as you say, we very much feel like we've opened a can of worms there, and we obviously don't have time to go into it in quite the depth that maybe we'd have liked to. Maybe that's a topic for another day, folks. So we've covered quite a wide area, and in some ways I think you've probably sort of already answered some of these questions. But what are some of the important considerations then for someone who is thinking of taking on this challenge, this very important role in bringing a new horse into the world and breeding a foal?
Yeah, someone I can jump in on this one. So there's just so much to consider. And I found myself in that position a few years ago when I was going to start a little bit of breeding from my mare. And there were things that I didn't even know that I needed to worry about, which makes it a bit more difficult when there are things you don't even know. So the biggest thing I think is probably having a plan. But this was part of the reason why we at the British Horse Foundation wanted to focus our attention on being able to provide some guidance to breeders, because there'll be many people, as I found, a little bit adrift, not knowing where to go to get the information that I needed. So we could spend hours talking about all these bits and pieces, from preconception, care of the mare, how do you choose the right stallion, the gestation period, the best way of foaling down, the first few days of the foal's life, weaning, and on from there. As you already said, we could spend hours talking about it. But what we have done at the British Horse Foundation is a series of webinars with the Pony Club about those very things. And we've also worked with the British Horse Society on their Breeding Challenge Awards, again, which is very similar, covering all of those topics. And then we've also produced some guidance as part of our Better Beginnings programme, which is where we present a lot of the cutting edge information that people may not yet be aware of. So I'm a very small scale breeder, single mare owner, and I only really breed for the horses. I want to keep them and I want to ride them myself. They're there for life. So I think for me, the single biggest thing, if I was trying to pick it out, was make sure that you really have enough time to dedicate to your mare and to your foal. It took so much more time than I ever thought. There's so many things that I just didn't realize that you needed to spend so much time on, particularly towards the end of pregnancy and the first 6 months of the foal's life. So everything from farrier visits every 10 days, potentially box rest if you have got a slight angular limb deformity and you need to restrict movement for a little while, hand grazing so they at least do get out and get some grass while they're straightening up, time spent just handling the foal, teaching it what a brush is for, teaching it how to wear a head collar and what the lead rope pressure means, how to move forwards and how to stop and to stop at gates and to turn politely around at the gate. All of those things that take up so much time, they obviously make your life so much easier later on in life with your horse, but they are time consuming. It's very rewarding. But yeah, if I could, one thing, make sure you have enough time and then probably double the amount of time that you think you need.
Yes, very good advice. Because I guess, again, it's the sort of thing we take for granted, that our horses know all these very, very basic fundamental skills. But actually, someone way back at the beginning has had to spend, as you said, hours putting these building blocks in place, training these things that we just don't even think about, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you've mentioned some really important things there. Why is it so vital that we take these considerations into account, as you say, spend some time doing some thinking, maybe doing some research, looking into all of this stuff, speaking to experts around you? Why is it so important that we do this? And what are some of the consequences maybe of going into this lightly and not maybe doing it to the best of our abilities?
That's a very good question, isn't it? And the reason that the British Horse Foundation is where we are, i.e. Better Beginnings, has been born from the work that myself and other veterinarians have done over a very long period. And over time, and being involved with the British Equestrian Federation Futurity for 20 years as lead veterinary surgeon, it slowly dawned upon me that an awful lot of the problems that I saw as a practicing vet in the 70s, 80s, and 90s were as a result of substandard practices in the young horses up to the age of 3 or 4. And it became increasingly obvious that as I saw horses with orthopedic problems, for instance, splints because they were turning their toes in, curbs because the hind toes had been left too long in the baby horse, or that the horse had been worked too hard too young, bone spavins in the young horse, again because of poor conformation, working too hard too young, working inappropriately, having asymmetrical hind feet, back problems because the horse had been asymmetric behind because of poor hoof balance, or orthopedic problems that could have been corrected when the animal was young. I remember team chasing in the 80s, and I had two horses, and after one I always had a slightly sore back myself on one side. It wasn't until some 30 years later that I realised it was because that particular horse had got a conformational defect behind. And of course, it was then making the rider uncomfortable. But had I known more, I would have realised his back was uncomfortable too. And so it is that a large number of cases that as veterinary surgeons we see and we're asked to try and correct from probably the age of 6 onwards, those cases may not have come before us had the juvenile horse been managed in a more empathetic manner, as we've just described. And I firmly believe that a lot of the problems that we have would be a large percentage of them would be avoided if just a little bit more understanding was apparent in the management of the young horse, as we've outlined.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's one of those, I think, that some people maybe can get a bit carried away with the idea of having a cute foal in their back garden and have it, you know, replicating their mare that they particularly enjoy. But as you've both said, there's so much more under the surface of this very important topic, and the consequences can be long term if you know it doesn't go right, doesn't go to plan. You've both mentioned during this conversation the Better Beginnings guide and resources that the British Horse Foundation has put together. Could you tell me a bit more about that, and anyone else who's listening who might be interested?
Yeah, so we actually recruited a few new trustees to the British Horse Foundation back in sort of 2020, 2021 sort of time. And we took the opportunity of having some new people to refocus what the aim of the British Horse Foundation was. So good breeding and young horse development practice has always been within the mission of the BHF, but we just wanted to narrow our focus to where we could really make a difference. And we came to believe that there just, as I've already mentioned, wasn't a sort of a single source of really good information that covered everything breeding and young horse development. There are some absolutely brilliant resources out there that cover care of the mare during pregnancy, foaling down, and things like that. And then there's, you know, other bits of information about the first few days of life, but there was nowhere where you could go and know that you could find all the information that you need to be able to make good decisions before you even decided to breed that foal. And it can be really difficult to keep on top of everything because new research is done every day and a new best practice guidance is available every day. And the breeding industry can be maybe a little bit known for being a little bit stuck in its ways. I think we can probably all be guilty of that a little bit. So what we wanted to do was just try to have a look at the information that was available and try and synthesize it down so that it was something that was sort of able to be consumed by everybody. So we hope that the Better Beginnings programme of work would make the process a little bit easier by doing that heavy lifting and providing the most useful and up-to-date information. So what we did was we tried to sort of split the young horse into two sections. So we've got, as Jane mentioned, inception, so before you've even begun to do anything to do with breeding, and then up to 2 years of age, and then from 2 years of age to 4 years of age. And we do this in 4 year cycles. So in year one, we would spend a year gathering information for the first section, inception to 2 years of age. And at the end of that first year, we'll have a conference where we'll invite everybody that we can to come speak at our conference and give us lots of new information. And then the second year, we will produce some guidance or some advice notes based on all the information that we've gathered together. And then as we move into year three, we'll start on the 2 to 4 year old horse and we'll repeat the cycle. So again, we'll spend a year gathering information and we'll have a conference at the end of that year. And then the fourth year, we release the guidance and the advice notes for the 2 to 4 year old horse. And that cycle carries on because there's always more information out there. So in that way, we can keep ourselves as up to date and as current as possible. So we'll be holding the conference later on this year on the 14th of October, which will be for the 2 to 4 year old horse, with the advice notes for the 2 to 4 year old horse being released in 2025.
And I think that the other thing that's really quite important is we all know we can't be all things to all men, and everybody has a different opinion about a lot of different subjects. So we try to take a very broad brush and sensible approach by engaging with academics, researchers, amateurs, professional producers, and end users. And in terms of end users, we all know that by far the largest proportion of end users have no portal of entry to any educational, formal education at all. So we're very, very aware of that. But also, of course, there is the elite section of the disciplines. And so we try as much as we can to collaborate with all the member bodies of the British Horse Foundation, from the Olympic disciplines to the Pony Club, who we've collaborated with extensively, and the British Horse Society. The British Horse Foundation is not a member body standing alone. The British Horse Foundation is a member body of the British Equestrian Federation for the benefit of all the other member bodies. I think that is really, really key to our modus operandi, really.
Yeah, well, I guess it is. It all starts with you guys, and then those horses are moving up into the various, as you say, the other member bodies. It's something that affects all of us in one way or another. If we interact with a horse, we are in some way in touch with how he started his life, really. So it's been a really interesting conversation, and we've thrown a lot around, and you know, I've learned a lot. I've really enjoyed doing this week because I've got to speak some really interesting people and learn a lot about it. But last of all, what would be for each of you, what would be your take home message then for anyone who's listening to this and interested in the subject?
So for me, I think it's the key message for all of the work that we're doing with the British Horse Foundation, I think, which is equip yourself with all the knowledge and the skills that you need to give your horse the very, very best start in life, both physically and mentally. And then you'll be set up for a long and happy partnership together, which I think is all any of us horse owners would really want.
I couldn't agree more. And my take home message, everything equestrian,
is understand the evolution of the horse. If you do, you're 9/10 of the way there. If you don't, it's likely to be a disaster and you could easily end up having an accident. So please, everyone, just make sure you understand the evolution of the horse and how it applies to the modern day horse.
Very wise words there. So if you've been listening to this and you'd like to find out more, we are going to put the links to the Better Beginnings resources on the page on our website that's devoted to all things Equine Health Week 2024. So make sure you go there, have a look, have a read. I really recommend it because it is very, very interesting. We've only scratched the surface today. I'd like to thank Jane and Kezia for joining me today. Hopefully you've enjoyed sharing your knowledge with us because it's things you're clearly very passionate about.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you, Rachel.
It's great, actually, that the BE, British Equestrian Federation, has brought us all together in this wonderful health week. I think it's a great format for all equestrians and good for the British Equestrian, I say.
Thank you very much. We are here to entertain, educate and, you know, impart some wisdom on everyone. So hopefully everyone is enjoying it as much as Jane clearly is. If you've missed any of the resources across this week, please do catch up on our website. There's a page there that everything is collated in one place. Obviously, we've had podcast episodes every single day, so please listen back to those. There have been some brilliant topics with some brilliant speakers. You can find them wherever you found this episode, or they are, as I say, all collated on the website. We've got one more day to go for Equine Health Week. We're sticking with welfare for that. So I hope you'll join us, and thank you very much for listening.